Good to see all of you in our study tonight. We're studying from Revelation chapter 13. I would encourage you to read Revelation 13 and 14 in one setting. We're not going to get through all of that, needless to say, in our study tonight, but I'm going to try to get into as much of the 13th chapter as I can. In our study tonight, we're going to begin the 13th chapter. The 13th chapter, we're going to be talking about the beast coming up out of the sea, likely tonight. I doubt that we get to the beast coming up out of the earth. I'd like to, and especially the last verse of this chapter, because it discusses the 666 as the mark of the beast. And everybody likes to talk about that, it seems. So we want to discuss that in some detail. Resources that are used, these will be on our website. I'm not going to take the time to go through those. They've been on a number of our charts so far. Usually as I start a new chapter, I put that up there so you can find that readily, and sometimes I add to it. So you'll see that from time to time. But in the first 11 chapters, let me hasten to say that as you read the 11th chapter, you know how the book of Revelation, as far as this ongoing battle, you know how it's going to end, because that's what the first 11 chapters are about. The second portion of the book, chapters 12 through 22, describes the why, that which is going on in the backdrop. What we have read and studied in chapters 1 through 11 deals with God's people on the earth and the persecution, the sufferings that they're enduring. And chapter 12 beginning describes a spiritual battle that is taking place in heaven. And so we want to discuss that, or have discussed that, as we began the 12th chapter and so forth. But in our study tonight, we're going to again approach this from this standpoint, that the victory is gained by God, and Christians are assured that we're going to be victorious. And if we can take that lesson home with us, then that will be a good thing. Here's a somewhat of a detailed discussion of the next few chapters, chapters 12 through 14, 15, 16, and so forth, as you see on the chart. I'm hoping to get a little further into the 13th chapter. It breaks down naturally into two divisions, the beast of the sea and the beast of the earth. And there's the verses as you see them before you. And I'm going to raise the point, what's the thing that's being discussed? I'm persuaded that what we're looking at in the book of Revelation is a fulfillment of what we have seen in Daniel chapter 7. That Daniel chapter 7 becomes the interpretive tool, in my judgment, of the book of Revelation, and Daniel chapter 2 becomes the interpretive tool of Daniel chapter 7. And so what we're looking at is the fall of that fourth empire or beast that's described in Daniel chapter 7. And that's what the book of Revelation is discussing. And I think you'll see the similarities as we go forward in our study even tonight. Here is an artist's depiction of what is taking place in the 13th chapter. And as we begin in the first verse, we noted last time, just barely to introduce the 13th chapter, that chapter divisions sometimes are unfortunate as to where they occur. I was talking with Donna this morning, suggested to her that chapter divisions were not inspired and verse divisions are not inspired, but they sure are helpful when we're trying to find something. But sometimes where they occur is most unfortunate, because it breaks the thought where the thought really is not broken and should not be broken. But you'll notice verse 1 begins with the word "and." So already we know that we're tying some things together. We noted in the 12th chapter the great dragon and the war taking place with Michael and that context, and the great dragon, of course, is defined for us in verse 9. We know who we're talking about, the devil, Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. So that takes that out of the realm of speculation. We know who we're talking about. And then beginning in verse 17 of the 12th chapter, it says, "And the dragon waxed wroth with the woman and went away to make war with the rest of her seed, that keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus." So we've got the dragon, which we know is the devil, Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. warring with the seed of the woman, which I believe in this context indicates those whose lives are righteous. They're doing the will of God, the redeemed, if you please. And then in verse 1, he, that is the devil, stood upon the sand of the sea. Now, some translations that you're reading from indicate that John was standing upon the sand of the sea. I wouldn't debate the point. I'm just reading from the American Standard Translation, and it appears, at least in the context, that the devil is standing upon the sand of the sea, and he's seeing these things. I don't believe that it does really any injustice to the text when you identify that as John standing upon the sand of the sea. But the vision is he saw a beast coming up out of the sea. And the text tells us that he had 10 horns and 7 heads, and on his horns, 10 diadems, and upon his heads, names of blasphemy. Now, just that description, Daphne, I don't know if you remember when we were in a Bible class together, there was a lady in that Bible class, is one of college classes, and she was just really distraught about the book of Revelation, because she pictured herself being caught up in this great war, that the book in these last few chapters is describing. And Collie was expounding to her that that's not something that's going to take place on this earth that she's going to be caught up in. And all the horribleness of what you're seeing on the screen here in the 13th chapter, verse 1 and some others, had her just really distraught. And when she finally concluded or understood that, no, it's not talking about a physical war that she needs to be concerned about, it was just a really big sigh of relief to her, a great burden lifted that she was not going to be caught up in that. But when you look at this picture that John is presenting for us here, a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns, 7 heads, and on his horns, 10 diadems, and upon his head, names of blasphemy. Don't that just scare you to death? And it's intended for that reason, to show you the horribleness of this battle that is ongoing between Satan's agents and the forces of good. And so this is how he is presented in this chapter with these two beasts that we're going to talk about. Well, I want us to note that the beast coming up out of the sea is not, as far as the use of the word sea is concerned, is not unusual in the book of Revelation. It's used many times. But what we want to note is the beast coming up out of the sea. He's not talking about a body of water over here, but he's talking about out of the mass of humanity, that here comes something that the devil has given authority to. Now, that just raises all kinds of intriguing questions, doesn't it? But you'll notice the indescribable horror that is presented just simply in the presentation of the image. You'll note there, beginning in verse 2, it says, "And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him great power and his throne and great authority." Now, that's just full of all kinds of great information that's going to be helpful to us. This beast came up out of the sea of humanity and described in vivid color, so to speak. The beast was like a leopard, like a bear, like a lion. And the dragon, that is the devil, gave him his power, gave him great authority. Now, that raises some questions as to who is this, or what is this that John is presenting for us here. Now, we've noted in earlier studies that the 10 horns indicates great power. That's fairly consistently used in Old Testament text. Some believe, and I think rightly so, that this beast, whatever it was, involves some kind of political power. But I want you to note that the authority that he had was given to him by the dragon, that is, by Satan. He was given authority to do something, and we're going to talk about what as we progress. You'll notice the 7 heads, the 10 diadems. We've talked about the diadems before. And we note that Satan has them on his head there in chapter 12, as we introduced that thought, verse 3. And we noted that the term diadem is not from the term Stephanos. We've noted that the Lamb wears the victory crown. This is what's promised to you when you overcome. And we've talked about that from Revelation 2 and verse 10. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown. That's the victory crown. Daphne?
Yeah. I just have a question about this. So we also know from other places in the Bible that God chooses the leaders and he puts in power who he wants. But here it's saying that, and I'm assuming this is talking about the Roman Empire, so Satan is behind this empire and these rulers. So would it be fair to say that God doesn't always install the rulers that he has handpicked? That sometimes Satan does installs rulers, and then God deals with them as he sees fit.
You know, so, that's such an interesting question. You see me grinning just a little bit.
Am I stealing your thunder again?
No, not at all. No, no, not at all on this point. The thing that I find so fascinating about that is we began this 12th chapter with an allusion back to Genesis chapter 3, essentially to the promise, verse 15. That God initially made to Eve, the seed of woman, I've got to get that turned right around. The serpent would bruise the heel, there we go, of the seed of woman, but the seed of woman would bruise the head of the serpent. And we've seen that from the beginning. And the thing that I find really interesting, I almost said fascinating, about that is that you see this ongoing throughout the history of Israel, throughout the history, even before there was such a thing as the nation of Israel. And at every point, whatever happens, it seems that Satan could say, I've got it this time. And then, well, now I've got it this time. And at every turn, no matter what happens, he's defeated. Even when Israel was taken into captivity, you could say, well, I've got them destroyed. When we talked about the period of Esther, we might note that, well, you know, when old Haman made the plan to destroy all the Israelites, go kill them all. All right, I've got them now. The God's plan through the seed of woman, it just can't come to pass. So, yeah, we've got a victory here. We've got a victory here. We've got evil kings in Israel that brought up a lot of this junk, the idolatrous worship. So, yeah, got a victory here. No, 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 it's short-lived because at every turn, Satan is conquered. So when we say, well, Satan has appointed or given certain ones power or authority, yes, within God's limitations. He's allowed to operate within God's limitations. And yes, we can look at passages like Isaiah 10, there beginning in verse 5, where he used the evil power of Assyria. We might reason and say, well, Assyria inflicted punishment on the people of God. So the Assyrian king raised to a place of power, but he was a wicked, evil, idolatrous king. And so Satan was putting him on the throne. No, his power was limited only to the extent that God allowed him to put him on the throne. God put him on the throne. So in that sense, yes. Does that make any kind of sense?
Yeah, it kind of does. Of course, the question that is running through my mind is, does this explain Hitler then? Because that's always what they bring up is, well, if God picks all the rulers, what was up with Hitler? Maybe he fits into this thing where he actually was given his authority by Satan, and then God dealt with him in his own time.
Well, I'd say that's probably purposes. As good a speculation as any. We're going to talk about Hitler when we get to 666. Some think that he is the one that's being discussed there. Mm-hmm. And so I'm excited about talking about that. But no, I don't believe that God puts men like Hitler in the places that they are in as a blessing. No. Evil guys.
Yeah.
No, evil guys. And in the instance here, you know, when we talk about Roman persecution, can God turn that around? These authorities that Satan has given some power to, can God just turn that right around to accomplish his purpose? I think we're going to see that even in the case of the Roman entities, the Roman powers, he did. He turned that right around to do just exactly what he promised to do, even with them in Daniel chapter 7. Yes, okay. Bruce?
Yeah, you know, we see the same thing with when Pharaoh,
yes,
you know, had put them in slavery.
Yes,
we see how often, you know, God has shown His power, and how Pharaoh completely hardened his heart. So we constantly see that in scriptures all the time.
And God turned that right around, didn't He? Destroyed him, and of course, then all the riches that Egypt had, then Israel got. And we see that was a matter of prophecy when He spoke to Abraham in Genesis chapter 15. He told him that they'll come out with great substance. Well, what substance? Everything that the Egyptians had put together over the centuries of time. The Israelites got it. So there you go. Now, getting back to this point, the 10 diadems and so forth, we note that the word that is used there is a word that, strangely enough, portrays royalty, great authority, but it's not victory. And that's what's promised, as we noted in Revelation 2:10 and other passages. The crown that Christ wears, we'll talk about that another time or more another time. But you'll notice also in this context, as he continues, that in verse 1, seven heads, and on his horn, 10 diadems, and upon his head, names of blasphemy. Now that becomes really interesting to me, because as we turn back to the Old Testament text of Daniel, chapter 7, look at how these beasts are described, in particular, the fourth beast. In Daniel chapter 7, let's begin doing some reading. For example, in verse 7, it says, after this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, terrible and powerful and strong exceedingly. And it had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with its feet. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it. And it had 10 horns. I considered the horns. Behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which three of the first horns were plucked up by the roots, and behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. Now, I want to note there in verse 8, the description of this fourth beast, as he describes him, involving a mouth speaking great things. Dropping down in that text to verse 11, he continues, I beheld at that time, because of the voice of the great words which the horn spake, and I beheld even till the beast was slain, and its body destroyed, and it was given to be burned with fire. Now this beast that was to be destroyed, this fourth beast that Daniel is describing, spoke great things, had great words, spoke with a great voice, and I might suggest to you at this point, words of arrogance. The translation or the text of Revelation 13 speaks of blasphemous names of blasphemy on his head. And I find that just incredibly more than a coincidence. Whatever Daniel was talking about, John is talking about too. And if you'll note how the description continues in Revelation 13, look at verse 2. And the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him great power, his throne, and great authority. Notice the description from Daniel chapter 7. I'm going to have to put my marker back there, because we're going to be going back and forth quite a little bit. Daniel chapter 7, begin reading again at verse 3. This is earlier than where we were a moment ago. Beginning at verse 3. Daniel said, and four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand upon 2 feet as a man. And a man's heart was given to it. And behold, another beast, second, like to a bear. And it was raised up on one side, and three ribs were in its mouth between its teeth, and they said thus unto it, arise, devour much flesh. After this I beheld, and lo, another, like a leopard, which had upon its back four wings of a bird, and the beast had also four heads, dominion and so forth. And then verse 7, we read about this fourth beast that is described. The language is very much the same as what we're reading over here in Revelation chapter 13. Now, if not, why not? Is Revelation 13 and Daniel talking about the same thing? Are they describing the same thing? Now, that's where you pipe up and say, well, it sure seems so. But that's the context. That's what they're discussing. The beast was like, that's an important word. This beast that came up out of the sea, Daphne, you're right. I believe that to be the Roman Empire. And John sees, and I think from Daniel chapter 7, when you tie in verse 7 with that text, what Daniel sees in Revelation 13 is somewhat of a composite of all of the above. It's not just one of these characteristics, the beast, the leopard, the bear. He is a composite of all of the above. And that's what John sees, this beast of verse 2. And you see from Daniel's description in Daniel chapter 7 how that would be so. When you read in Daniel chapter 2 and read of the description that he gives of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar saw, the head of that image, the head of gold, what kingdom did that represent? The kingdom of Babylon, ruled over by Nebuchadnezzar. And then Daniel said there's going to be another one. And we know that to be both biblical history and world history, the Medo-Persian Empire, a combination of the Medo-Persian Empire. And then he said there's going to be a third kingdom. Well, we know that to be the Greek or Alexandrian Empire. And then in verse 40, he said there's going to be a fourth kingdom, and it's going to be strong like iron and so forth, but it's going to be a divided kingdom. How many years have we described that as the Roman Empire, during which time God was to establish his kingdom that would stand forever? Now, what we know in these world kingdoms or empires that Daniel is telling Nebuchadnezzar about in chapter 2 is they don't last. They never last. World kingdoms just don't. But during the days of this fourth kingdom, God is going to set up his, and it will last. Nothing will ever destroy it. It'll last forever and ever. And that's how Daniel describes it in Daniel chapter 7. These others in Daniel chapter 7, they will fall, but the Lord's kingdom will not. Now, in describing that fourth kingdom, that fourth beast, he uses these analogies like a bear, like a leopard, terrible, like a lion, and very similar to what we're seeing in Revelation chapter 13. I'm persuaded he's talking about the same one. Now, the question then is, what did the dragon give? Gave power, gave throne and great authority. Who'd he give it to? I'm convinced he gave it to the Roman Empire. And what did they do with it? They used it to browbeat people to worship the empire or to worship the emperors of the empire. And there wasn't just one that demanded worship. Sometimes we talk about Nero. Well, that had to be Nero that's being discussed because he required emperor worship. From what I've studied, he did not demand emperor worship or invoke the death penalty if emperor worship was not practiced throughout the empire. That was primarily restricted to the area of Rome. But these letters are addressed to the seven churches of Asia. And so what we want to note here is that though Nero, yes, he did require emperor worship, not as widespread as some of the other Roman emperors. And often we talk about Domitian. He was not the only one either. There were a number of Roman emperors that demanded that they be worshiped. Some were worse than others. Some inflicted worse penalties for violation than others. And so that's open for obvious discussion. But here's the description that we see. A leopard, feet of a bear, mouth of a lion. I'm persuaded he's describing the same thing that Daniel was describing. And Daniel was describing, I think, the ending of this as a world entity or world empire. Now, some have speculated, what does the leopard mean? And they said, well, that was maybe characteristic of the Grecian army for their quickness to conquer. I don't know about that. Some could argue about the feet of the bear and say, well, we've got terrible power that is indicated by the Medes and the Persians joining forces. And I've read some material relative to that. I don't know that that's true. Why the writer uses these particular critters or animals to describe these empires, but we do know what he's describing. He's describing world empires. And when we talk about the Roman Empire, its ability to conquer was quite incredible, much like a lion, as we see the description displaying those qualities. Now, the dragon gave the beast power. Daphne, to address your point, the real power behind the empire was that which was provided by Satan. I think that it's true that he delegated power to Rome. And somebody said, well, where does that put God? Because he rules in the kingdoms of men. That puts Rome limited. Whatever Satan can do, he's limited by God. Whatever he allows him to do. You remember with Bruce, I saw your hand. I'll get to you in just a second. When we read the book of Job, you remember that whatever Satan did to Job, and as horrible as it was, God drew the line and said, you can go to here, but you can't go any further. And I think that's what we see with some of these things as well. Bruce, go ahead.
Yeah, but it seems like in verse 1, when it's talking about blasphemy, all what these kingdoms have done are insult to God.
Well, they are, yes, and especially this one that we're describing here, because this one claimed to be God, wanted to be recognized and worshipped as God. Daphne?
Yeah, I was going to say that. It says that the name on his head was blasphemous, and if they're claiming for themselves godhood, then that is, they're claiming that as their name,
yeah,
their identification, and that is blasphemous. So I think that it probably refers to the fact that they did think of themselves this way and call themselves to be that.
Well, I've read some material that indicates that even in correspondence during this time, that the Roman emperor would only be addressed as Lord God. Right. Now, could you do that? Well, no, not as a Christian. You couldn't even send him a letter and address him like that. You couldn't do that. Randy. I heard somebody.
It's Randy.
Okay, yeah, I don't see you, but go ahead.
You know, even in Job, Satan had to ask permission to do anything to Job. He was granted permission, but that doesn't change the fact that he doesn't have any power in and of himself. It has to be granted to him. But my understanding of Satan ever since then is his only power is deception. That doesn't mean it's not a great power. That is a great power. I mean, the power to deceive and the, you know, being the father of lies. But that's really what seems to be the power that he gave Rome was the ability to deceive people into thinking that Caesar was God or that the Roman army was invincible, or that the empire was invincible. But again, that it is a great power to be able to deceive, but followers of God are enlightened. You know, once you know the truth, then you're not deceived.
Right. We're going to look at that concerning not only this beast, but the second beast that came up out of the earth. In verse 14, it tells us that he deceiveth them that dwell on the earth. And even evidently had the appearance of being able to do signs. We're going to be able to talk about that more detail when we get to that. But I wanted to call your attention to the latter part of verse 14, because he would say to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast who hath the stroke of the sword and live. That's not the verse I was looking for. Verse 15 is the next one. And it was given unto him to give breath to it, even to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as should not worship the image of the beast should be killed. Now that tells us the extent of the authority that was given. You worship the beast or the dragon or his image, one and the same, I must say. We'll look at that in just a moment. If you worship the beast, then you're worshiping Satan. If you're worshiping the Roman emperor, you're worshiping Satan. I'm not saying that the Roman emperor is Satan, but that's the ultimate end of where you're going with that. And what does the beast have the authority to do if you don't? He has the authority to put you to death. He has that authority. Now, would that perhaps even go a little bit beyond, Randy, simply deception? It'd be easy to believe something and do something if I knew if I didn't, I'd die. Maybe a horrible death. So what we've got is some real motivating power that is given to this beast. And I think we're going to see that as it develops. You'll note that he has the ability to act, great authority, but limited. We've looked at this two or three times already, that God rules in the kingdoms of men. And of course, here are a number of passages, I think, that help us with that, to understand that Satan does have power, but it's within the parameter that God gives him. He's described as the God of this world, but he's described as one that has been and will be ultimately defeated. And so we'll have more to say about that. Ephesians 2, verse 2, he's described as the prince of the powers of darkness. And a host of these passages use similar terminology. So he still does have power, but limited. He's a formidable foe. We often noted from 1 Peter chapter 5, and verse 8, he's one to be feared. He's described as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. But as a mad dog that's tethered, he's under God's limitations. Okay, any questions just here? Good comments and questions so far. Appreciate your input. In verse 3, he continues, "And I saw one of his heads as though it had been smitten unto death, and his death stroke was healed, and the whole earth wondered after the beast. And they worshiped the dragon, because he gave his authority unto the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast, and who is able to war with him?" Two or three things I want us to note in this. One is, on one of his heads, it was as though he had been smitten unto death, but his death stroke was healed, and the whole earth had occasion to wonder. Now, they worshiped the dragon. I wanted to make this note, and we'll go back and talk about verse 3 some more. Because he gave his authority. Who's the he here? You follow that back. Who's giving the authority? The dragon. He gave his authority unto the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast and who is able to war with him? The dragon is the one that gave the authority. Now, when the dragon gave the authority, Daphne, to your point, when you worship the beast, who are you worshiping?
Satan.
You're essentially worshiping him who gave the authority. You're worshiping Satan. And that's, I think, what we see in verse four. It says, and they worshiped the dragon because he gave his authority unto the beast. So that's a simple point. Now, the Roman emperor who demanded worship, you bow down before him and call him God. Well, there's only one God. So who have you now become the worshiper of? It's not just that man. You've become the worshiper of the devil himself because you've abandoned God. Now, in John's day, the beast embodied the form, I'm persuaded, of the Roman Empire. I think that's what Daniel is very simply pointing to. He's always used men's kingdoms as instruments against God's reign. And that has historically been true. Even when we look back and see, Daphne, as you pointed out, the temptations that were given by idolatrous nations. Why didn't God want his people to intermarry with the heathen nations?
Because it would change them.
It changed them. That's right. And it certainly did. If this nation over here worships the beast, as it were, they worship emperors or worship images or whatever, and you're tied somehow into that, you marry somebody like that, you're going to do the same thing. And that's what we see Solomon did multiple times. And so that's what Satan has always done, used men's kingdoms as instruments against God's reign. That's not unusual. But he never wins, not in the end. His win seems only short-lived, because God rules in the kingdoms of men. He can use a wicked king like the king of Assyria to punish his people. And he can use a wicked king like Nebuchadnezzar to conquer the Assyrians, and then use a man like Cyrus to destroy them. And then here we go. And so we look at these wicked kingdoms and wicked kings, and though it seems that Satan uses those only within the limitations that God allows, and then God turns it right around and uses them. Now, what we're going to study when we get a little further along is only the lamb has the power to overcome the beast. He can do that. Now, if the lamb has the power to overcome the beast and you follow and worship the lamb, now what's that do for you? That makes you the victor, don't it? And that's where we're going with this. And I think that it will become more and more apparent as we progress down through these chapters. One of the beast heads was wounded unto death, but since he had seven, his life was not taken. That's an interesting point to me. Many suggest that the wounded head was Nero. I'm sorry? Thought I heard somebody. Many suggest that the wounded head was Nero. He took his own life in 68. He died at a very young age, I understand. After Nero, the empire suffered a period of time of confusion. Order was restored by Vespasian, but the healing of the death stroke, what'd that mean for those who are Christians? Now, if you say, well, Nero punished those who were Christians a little bit, and then we've got another king that comes on the throne, and so he wants to pursue this idea of emperor worship. What does that do to the death stroke of the king such as Nero? Some invented the theory that may have some merit, that Nero was reincarnated. That's not the word they used, but it became a myth that Nero lived again in the lives of other kings that did some of the same things, only perhaps to a worse extent, worse degree. Well, what it meant then was persecution for Christians. And some believe that under the reign of Domitian, that it was somewhat of a, here's the expression, of Nero revived, if you please. And that's what some believe that this passage is teaching. It very well may be that you've got a rebirth of emperor worship in the life of another Roman emperor. Now, some have suggested, and I don't believe this has a great deal of merit, that the seven heads represent Rome and the world power in control. In time, Rome would be fatally wounded, but another nation would rise up and replace Rome. And so it became a repeating cycle. I don't believe that's so. I don't believe that's so because I don't believe that's what Daniel was prophesying. Daniel was prophesying in Daniel chapter 7, and I think we see the fulfillment of that in the book of Revelation, that here's where it ends. We're not going to have another world empire where the emperor is worshipped. And I think that's exactly what Daniel was prophesying. So this idea of the rebirth of emperor worship in another king very well may be so, but not another kingdom, not another kind of kingdom. That kingdom would end. Daphne?
Yeah, it just, and I don't even know where to go with this. It just popped into my head, though, that actually during the time of Constantine, it did kind of change. And there was another kingdom that covered the world and had one man that ruled almost as God, not necessarily God himself, but as his spokesperson. And that was the Catholic Church with the Pope at the head.
Some take that position, that that's what the book of Revelation is about. I don't believe that because, again, I don't think that's what Daniel was prophesying.
Yeah. Like I said, I don't know for sure. I was like, I wonder how that fits into it. So
I don't think it fits Daniel's prophecy. I just don't. And, yes, there are things that can be learned from that approach. I don't think that's what the book of Revelation is about, but certainly there's an application of the principles of the book of Revelation to those kind of things. So that's my thinking on that. If you want to read a source that takes that position, John T. Hines in the Gospel Advocate series, his commentary on the book of Revelation takes that approach. I've read it. I don't agree with him, but that's the approach that he takes, that is talking about the Catholic Church. Another thing I think that is an error in that position, Daphne, is that John is writing about things that must shortly come to pass.
Yeah, that's true.
The Catholic Church and the things that it did in its heyday were probably, what, in the neighborhood of 700, 800 years? Mm-hmm. down the pike. So there were other things that I think that fulfilled Daniel's prophecy that fit with the things that we're discussing here in the book of Revelation much, much better.
Yeah, I was just thinking it because when Constantine blended the state with the church, it became another, it's like Rome continued, but in another form. So yes. As long as you have the Catholic Church having power, you still have Roman rule.
Yes, though that be true, you didn't have the persecution of the saints like you had during the days of the worship of the emperor.
Okay, I'm going to stop now.
Well, agreed. You know, you could talk about the Dark Ages and that sort of thing. I'm familiar with those arguments, and there's some merit to them, but I don't think that fits the book of Revelation.
Yeah.
I don't think that's what John is talking about.
I was just pondering.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting word. Yeah, it's good to ponder. That's all right. Well, this beast, whatever it was, and I think it was the Roman entity at this point, seemed to be invincible, caused all the world, and that's the word used, to worship the beast, the whole earth, verse 3, and they worship the dragon, and that's what that's about. So to worship one would be, in principle, worshiping the other. They would become enamored by the beast's power, his authority, and so forth and so on, which certainly the Roman emperors did. Nothing is comparable, at least so they think, to the power that has been given to them. Nothing can succeed, so they think. Nothing can make war. And you can see in verse 7 that it would be difficult, not verse 7, verse 4, who is likened to the beast and who is able to war with him? When you see this huge monster that demands emperor worship and you see people dying because they're not worshiping the beast, and life would be a lot simpler for you. We'll see in this chapter that you couldn't buy and sell. You couldn't engage in commerce and all kinds of things unless you participated in this. So you're out of business. You, your family, everything's gone. So they see this as an enemy that they cannot conquer. And some were just giving up. Now, keep in mind that it wasn't that they had to be devout worshipers of the emperor, but they had to pledge their allegiance to the emperor at least once a year and burn incense to him. Could you do that? Well, no. So this becomes somewhat of a political matter, as well as a matter of your strong convictions. You can't do that. Now, Revelation 3, look at verse 5. Got my bubbles in there. I didn't have them the animation. Look at verse 5. And there was given to him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. And there was given him authority to continue 42 months. I find that just incredibly interesting. When you turn again back over to Daniel chapter 7, and read there beginning at verse 8, verse 11, verse 25, what do we find this fourth beast doing? What was he doing? Well, it tells us that he was full of arrogance, that he spoke great things, verse 8, and verse 11, great words that he spake. And you'll note also in Daniel chapter 7, the text tells us that in verse 25, he shall speak words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and he shall think to change the times and the law. Let me pause right there. Who is the he?
Satan.
Not here.
The beast.
Who is the he that would speak great words against the Most High and would wear out the saints?
The fourth beast.
The fourth beast, yes. The fourth beast. Now, you'll notice he shall think to change the times and the law. Now, how long would he do that? They shall be given into his hand until the times, and half a time. But then what would happen? The judgment shall be set, and they shall take away his dominion and consume and to destroy it unto the end. Now, who's he describing? Who's the he?
The
fourth beast. Now, who's the fourth beast?
Roman Empire.
The Roman Empire. Yeah. Now, how long would he have that authority? Times, half a time. Now, it's not by accident when we come over to the book of Revelation that is the expression that is used. time, times, and half a time. When you look at Revelation chapter 11 in verse 3, when you describe the two witnesses, it says, and they shall prophesy 1,200, 80 days in sackcloth, clothed in sackcloth. How long is that? 1,200 days. You do the math. I'll suggest to you that it's the 42 months that we're reading about here. I'll suggest to you as well that it's the same thing as the 3.5 years, the time, times, and half time that Daniel is talking about back over here. Time, time, and half time, 42 months, 3.5 years, all the same thing. And it's not by accident that this term is used, and it's describing this indefinite amount of period of time, but a time of persecution, a time of turmoil for the people of God. Now, my question is he describing the same time that Daniel was describing? Is John describing the same period of time that Daniel was describing? I believe he is. I believe he is. And so this beast, I should say, they worship the beast, say, who's like him? That he would be given a mouth to speak great things, blasphemies, and how long would he do it? For 42 months. Same time frame that Daniel was talking about, Daniel chapter 7. Same time frame that John was talking about in Revelation 11, 12, and, well, twice in chapter 12. I knew it was multiple times. So, same time frame, and he would do this.
Also 11... Also 11:2.
11:2, yes. 42 months, yes. 11:2. Okay, that's significant. Put those on your chart. Well, again, what I would like for you to do is to read Revelation 13 and 14 in preparation for our studies. Read it several times. Read the book of, or not the book, but the chapter, chapter 7 in particular of the book of Daniel, several times, and see if you can make some connection between that chapter and the book of Revelation. What I want us to see is the same picture that we saw in chapter 11 of the book of Revelation, as chapter 12 and or chapter 13 and 14 continue. I think you'll see the same conclusion, and you'll see also a motivation. Let me just throw this out for you to gnaw on a little bit. When you look at verse 18, he that hath understanding, let him count the number of the beast. For it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Everybody wants to talk about that, and I know you're just chomping at the bit to be able to talk about that. But this chapter division between 13 and 14 is at a most unfortunate place. Chapter 14 continues, and I saw, and behold, the Lamb standing on the Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 having his name and the name of his father on their forehead. Now, we talk about the mark of the beast in verse 18 of the previous chapter, and we talk about those who had the mark of the beast on their right hand and on their forehead, didn't have the ability to buy and sell, and this horrible image that's presented. And sometimes all we can think about is wonder what man that is. And boy, that's just become the battleground of speculation. We've got it being this one, this one, this one. Even some have introduced Hitler, Saddam Hussein, and other politicians over the years have been identified as the one that gives the mark of the beast. This is him, 666. I think it's just a shame that chapter 13 don't include the first part of chapter 14, because you can either receive the mark of the beast and worship and serve him, or you can receive the mark of the Lamb and worship and serve him. Now, what's going to happen to the beast over here and those who receive his mark?
Yeah.
Going to be destroyed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, those over here, on the other hand, who receive the mark of the Lamb, what's going to happen to them?
Certainly.
Yeah. Now, you make a choice which one you want to receive. And we're going to approach it from that standpoint. And I'm not going to be dogmatic and say, well, it's this man. No, I don't think it's necessarily a particular man. I'll show you why as we get to that. I think that it's any man that sees himself as God and you decide I want to follow him. No, you follow the Lamb because there's victory there. The only thing that's going to result otherwise is death. Now, that's just a real brief 2-minute introduction to about a month's worth of stuff I'd like to talk with you about. Okay, I'll quit there. Bruce, question, comment?
Yeah, you know, and going through Daniel and knowing that this is really, you know, Rome and how they're being destroyed, but you asked a question to us, I guess it's been several months ago, about dying twice and living once, you know, and it reminds me of that, you know, it, or being born twice and then die, was it, die, and it kind of reminds me of that.
Yeah. You know,
so the beast is going to be, is going to die twice. And we, but what I'm seeing here is in Revelation, you know, if you follow him, no matter what, you're going to die.
Yeah.
You're going to die eternally.
Not a lot of motivation to follow him, is it?
Not at all.
Yeah. Now you're right on cue there, Bruce. If you follow the Lamb, however, you might be persecuted even unto death. But then what? You live.
You'll live eternally.
That's a good place for us to offer the invitation. Maybe I'm talking to somebody who knows what you need to do about your soul. You know you're not right. Why not fix it? Christ died to make that possible for us. If you believe that, so committed to that, willing to turn from your sin and repentance, confess your faith, why not be baptized? Enjoy the remission of your sins through the blood of Christ. You can do that tonight. We'll help you. Maybe it's your desire to confess sin and ask these brethren to pray for you. We'd be happy to do that. Any way we can help you to be right with the Lord, make that known.